Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a whole lot of studies on how to repair what's going wrong in your body. The first will be about sleep and how sleep repairs your damaged DNA in the neurons in your brain. This is Bar Elim University in Israel. We're also going to have a guest in the second part of our program. She is a award-winning journalist, Alana Samuels, and we're going to talk about how Wall Street and its investors, like hedge funds, with Washington's help, have entered the home and apartment rental market business, which means that the people who helped cause the Great Recession of 2007 are now the people profiting from it, and the average American is a victim of it. Also today, we're going to talk back to the New York Times for what we consider irresponsible reporting. They have promoted a woman, her name is Gerbic, and we have done some research and background checked. How the Times, with all of its resources, could have missed the real story is beyond us, but they did, so we'll cover it. Also, the New York Times and other publications have made a big point that the latest study shows no connection between vaccines and autism. That is not true. We will show you the truth on that. And also, I'm going to play you a part of an interview by two tenured professors. They're both liberal professors, on the massive hoax exposing social justice in academia. I'll explain what this means once we go to that segment of our program, and I'll take a call or two from our audience. I took 22 minutes for one call yesterday, so I don't have that much time to give those answers today, but we'll get to some. We began with this latest study about sleep. It was Ernest Hemingway's prized sleep for good reason, not only to dwell on rest and recuperation. The novelist saw snoozing as a form of damage limitation. He talked about how he loved sleep and how it helped him. Well, his observation is truer than what he could have imagined. Scientists have discovered that broken DNA builds up in brain cells in the daytime, and the repair works in reverse. It reverses that and starts cleaning up your brain, much like at an office at night, the lights go off and the janitorial services come in, they clean up everything. That's what your brain does. And that's one of the reasons we need sleep, and that's the reason some people need a little more sleep than others. They have more damage to clean up. So it's universal. Sleep has an enormous amount of benefits, and it doesn't matter what the creature is, dogs, cats, humans, all these need sleep for restoring rejuvenation, learning, memory, because when you're deprived of sleep, you're fatigued, your immune system is challenged, more susceptible to infections, and you stress easier. So now we know. Getting the neurons and the chromosomes protected and getting the DNA that is broken and no longer beneficial out of the system, that's what sleep does. So that's why we should make sure we get a good night's sleep. From Cornell University comes a study about the pungent, bitter onion varieties. Those are the ones that fight cancer. Traditional societies have long ascribed the healing properties to fruits and vegetables with strong taste or pungent odors, like ginger, turmeric, garlic, onions. Scientists are now understanding that these properties, including the humble onion, are important, not just for the culinary benefit. So aside from the fibers in onion that prevent heart disease and certain types of cancer, researchers are discovering other chemicals and compounds in onions that are proving to be beneficial to our health. And among the compounds that researchers have found are phytochemicals. I've mentioned this many times. These compounds, such as flavonoids, phenolic acids, protect onions from damage caused by bacteria and viruses and fungi. They're also known as antioxidants, and because they stop oxidative stress. That's the same process that causes rust in metals. They help remove free radicals or unstable oxygen atoms in the body that could damage cells and proteins and DNA. So now they found that these onions and these flavonoids help reduce your risk of diabetes and heart disease. They also reduce and prevent the proliferation of cancer cells in the colon and the liver. And the ones that have the greatest impact, at least four onion varieties that contain the highest amounts. The one you're probably used to using, the Western yellow, the pungent yellow, the Northern red, and the one that's the best for your overall health is the Northern red. That's why chopping up some red onions and putting them in your salad is really good. And shallots. Those are all good for helping prevent colon and liver cancer. University of Southern California, published in Cell Reports. Fasting as a mimicking diet is very important with people who have digestive problems. Now, what do I mean? Anytime you're on a low-calorie diet, we call it a fasting mimicking diet. So you're still having some nutrition, but you're limiting your total caloric intake. It would be like taking a gigantic salad, you know, the one the size of a bushel basket, literally a bushel basket. By the time you juiced all the things in there, whether it's arugula or watercress, lettuces, you end up with about a 16-ounce glass of juice. That's it. So it shows you why juice is the absolute powerhouse of enzymes, healing, alkalinity that the body needs, because you'd otherwise have to eat a bushel basket to get the equivalency. And also, probably 50% of what's in a salad will not be digested. It'll go through your intestine, but there's too much cellulose, too much fiber, and it won't all be broken down. Where if you juice, you've already extracted the water and the phytonutrients, chlorophylls, from the fiber, so you're going to get 100% of that, 50% of the other, and you have to eat 10 times more, 20 times more, of the salad to get what you would get in a juice. Now, the juicing is real fasting. The salad is fasting mimicking. So you're actually eating a food that's low in calories, and therein is the key. And they both do the same thing. That's the importance. So to turn off inflammation, reverse inflammatory bowel disease, reverse other conditions based upon inflammation, you have to go to a fasting mimicking diet, meaning you reduce the total calories coming in, you have none of the saturated fats coming in, and none of the, well, what would be arachidonic acid, which is from meat and dairy, that causes pain, that causes inflammation. So you can have foods on a fasting mimicking program, but they're low calorie foods. All right, but it really helps you, turns off inflammation. From the University of Illinois, they looked at 18,000 adults and found the majority of them have tap water as their primary water, and that is important to have water, though of course you should have filtered water or mineral water. Because tap water, unless you have a filter, is very polluted. But drinking more water is associated with numerous dietary benefits. People who increase their consumption of water by one or two or three cups daily decrease their total energy intake by over 200 calories a day. That's important because it's those excess calories that ends up causing us problems like obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. So drink more water throughout the day, or better still, juice. That's a lot better than water, because 98% of juice is water, but you're also getting all the other nutrients, enzymes, phytonutrients with that. This was published in the journal Human Nutrition Dietetics. It's hard to imagine the average person does not drink a lot of water, but they do drink a lot of coffee and sodas. And unfortunately, coffees and sodas contain caffeine, and caffeine is a diuretic. So you actually take water out of the body. You can become dehydrated drinking a lot of coffee and soft drinks. Not just is the water you're taking out, you're also taking out calcium, zinc, selenium, and magnesium. So it's not good. Vanderbilt University looked at a link between magnesium and vitamin D, and they found that the health benefits of vitamin D cannot be overstated. If you're low in vitamin D, you're more susceptible to diabetes, stroke, autism, respiratory conditions, depression, Alzheimer's, even skin conditions and cancer. So achieving optimal vitamin D is not difficult, generally 3,000 to 5,000 units a day. And the Vanderbilt Center published an article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that magnesium is crucial to optimize the level of vitamin D. So if your magnesium levels are too low, therefore you're probably also low in vitamin D. So to avoid that, it's best to take vitamin D and magnesium at the same time. I would suggest 1,500 to 2,000 units of vitamin D. I would suggest 500 to 700 milligrams of magnesium. And that will help you because they work synergistically. And most people are not aware of that. From Johns Hopkins University Hospital comes a study about a daily cup of tea can soothe your heart. That's right. Drinking as little as one cup of tea daily is good for your overall cardiovascular system and can help prevent heart attacks and other cardiovascular events. And the study also found that tea drinkers were less likely to have calcium buildup in the heart's coronary arteries. And it's the calcium deposits that have been linked to serious conditions like heart disease, stroke, and atherosclerosis. So green tea would be great. Oolong tea, white tea, also good for you. But get the tea in and strengthen your heart. And from St. Joseph's Hospital, which is in Germany, sodas and sugar-sweetened beverages are linked to more severe symptoms of people with MS. So if you suffer, know someone who does, from multiple sclerosis, drinking around 290 calories per day of soda, and that's like one can or less, or any sugar-sweetened beverage, would be tied to a more severe symptoms and a higher level of disability compared to people who did not drink these. So if you have MS, get rid of all the sodas in your diet. That's the latest on health and healing. Oh, I'm going to talk more in depth on this in the future, but from Linwood University in Missouri, ashwagandha could be the next workout supplement. So if you want to boost your performance, or even your racing, try ashwagandha, A-S-H-W-A-G-A-N-D-H-A, ashwagandha. It's also known as Indian ginseng. In a recent study published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients, it revealed supplementing with ashwagandha significantly enhances both upper and lower body strength. That's good. So we try to bring you information that really makes a difference. And for diabetics, for those who are known diabetics and those who are not known but still have prediabetes, a new study from the Illinois Institute of Technology shows that anthocyanins in strawberries improve insulin resistance. So that could help you if you're prediabetic or diabetic. Strawberries. Get the organic strawberries. They're easy to get. If you can't find them in season, get them frozen. It is not often that you have a legislator who has the truth at their beck and call, does their research, and then addresses the issue. As we know, there are two legislators who are making an effort on behalf of their constituents to influence Mark Zuckerberg, chairman and chief executive of Facebook. One is trying to get anything that's critical of vaccines off, and that's succeeding. In fact, almost all of the 7 million parents who have 3.5 million autistic syndrome children, they don't have a voice. Facebook doesn't believe any of them. Aren't we in supposed to be that believe someone movement? Well, no one's believing these parents or these women. So Zuckerberg got that, and he's running with it. But there's another legislator, and here's what he wrote. If vaccines do not cause injuries, why has the Vaccine Injury Trust Fund paid out $4,061,322,557 for vaccine injuries? Dear Mr. Zuckerberg, I am supportive of childhood vaccines and believe that parents should have their children vaccinated against vaccine-preventable illnesses. I also respect the right of parents to make fully informed medical decisions, including those regarding vaccinations. Decisions about vaccinations, like all medications, should be decided based upon the family's medical history, including allergies and a history of autoimmune diseases, as well as other factors. I also agree with our nation's public health officials and federal agencies that vaccines can have life-threatening and debilitating effects on some children and adults. The number of serious adverse reactions may be small on a population level, but to children who suffer lifelong debilitation in the families that care for them, it is no small matter. It is something they live with every day. It is life-altering and often all-consuming. A media report suggests that Facebook is considering limiting the free speech of Americans who present safety concerns about vaccinations online, including on Facebook and within Facebook groups. I have some questions about this matter and would also like to provide some facts regarding blatantly false information you received in a February 14th letter from my colleague, Representative Adam Schiff. The letter states, quote, "There is no evidence to suggest that vaccines cause life-threatening or disabling diseases," end quote. However, the Institute of Medicine, the Center for Disease Control, and the manufacturers all acknowledge that vaccines can cause harm to infants, children, and adults. The vaccine injury table, listing a wide range of more than 50 adverse reactions for recommended mandated vaccines, is available. I have serious concerns that Facebook, based on false statements and similar ill-informed assertions, may initiate limits on the free speech of Americans who enjoy the community sharing of information and ideas online through Facebook. There is likely not a more contentious topic in medicine today than vaccinations. As a legislator who has monitored these safety concerns while serving in the Florida legislature and since entering Congress 2008, I know there are many layers to this issue, including concerns about the fidelity of some of the safety studies conducted in the last 20 years. And then he goes on to talk about the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Fund, and that's one of the most difficult courts in the world to get a positive verdict in. And yet, there have been thousands, 6,300 people who have been vaccine injured, and just in the last 4 years, who have gotten compensated. So there's a lot of injuries, and he's saying, keep your form open. And that's good. Good for him. I commend Representative Bill Posey, member of Congress. Now we're going to close out our program today. We can't do the full testimony, but I insisted upon having open public hearings before New York State mandated health vaccines, four of them, all containing mercury, over 100 micrograms of mercury. And any of you, you don't have to be a scientist, can go to the toxicological literature, the peer-reviewed literature, go to the Library of Medicine, the government's own webpage, and look under mercury and aluminum, and you'll see thousands of studies that these are neurotoxic. And the amounts that you would put into a nurse, a physician, anyone in a hospital's body is just unconscionable. So I raised hell. I went to Albany. 1,400 of the listeners joined me. We protested. We got a meeting with members of the health committee. And then and only then, instead of mandating immediately vaccines, they had public hearings. I was the first to sign up. I was first there at 8 o'clock in the morning. But I was the last one called at night, 8 o'clock at night. Here is part of my testimony, and as you will see, I came prepared, and I was not about to, let's say, in any way defer to their authority on the subject matter. I'm going to try to bring four separate pieces of the puzzle together. Some of it may include some of what you've already heard, but I know for a fact much of it is different. There's an old Jewish saying, a half-truth is a full lie. I begin my discussion by asking two basic questions. Are vaccines safe? If so, what is the proof? Are vaccines effective? If so, what is the proof? I am not talking about all vaccines, though this applies to all vaccines, specifically on what we're dealing with. I have reviewed the scientific literature extensively. I have spent the last 7.5 years with thousands of hours of research on the subject of autism and what connections they may have to environmental factors, including vaccines. Not just the thimerosal in vaccines, but the other ingredients as well. I produced an award-winning documentary called Autism Made in USA. I produced a separate documentary called Vaccine Nation, representing all sides. All of it, the primary sponsor in the United States, vaccines in general, is in there and has his say. I then did something that I thought had been done, and I was surprised when I realized it had not. When I began to review what amounted to thousands of peer-reviewed literature studies on vaccines, I found that I could find no convincing evidence that any vaccine at all had long-term, double-blind, placebo-controlled study trials, and even when they said, when the evidence I did examine, that the CDC and the FDA and other organizations were using as, oh, of course they're studies, and they showed the studies, they would say, well, this is a study, and then I would find that, well, you left out the virus part of the vaccine, but you included all the other ingredients, including thimerosal and mercury and formaldehyde, etc. Well, that's not a placebo. And in good science, you don't use that as a placebo. I also saw that virtually all the studies that were supporting the vaccines were done by the vaccine manufacturers. And since the FDA does not do independent studies on the creation, safety, and efficacy of vaccines, but rather relies upon the information from the vaccine manufacturers, and there's a very close relationship, I then took a very careful look at this relationship and found that more than 50% of people sitting on the FDA and the CDC's vaccine advisory program were from vaccine manufacturers. I felt this was a gross conflict of interest. The rationale was given that there are not enough experts who are independent to sit on these committees. Now, I thought that's absurd. There are more than 3 million outstanding scientists in the United States. Don't tell me you can't find 15 who have no industry affiliation to sit on a vaccine scheduling committee. I then took a careful look, and here's what I found. And this is where you have to bring the pieces together or you lose sight. We're too close, too narrow on this issue. First, when a child is given a vaccine, adults given a vaccine, a senior citizen is given a vaccine, rarely, if ever, has anyone done any study that I can find, and I'm open to the fact I may not have found one that was done, but I looked at thousands, where they looked at combinations of vaccine used in the given individual to see what short and long-term impact it might have had. Now, the panel before said that only 2% of vaccine adverse reactions are reported. The highest number I could find was the FDA's 10%. When you consider that $1.3 billion has been given out in vaccine damage, and you consider that the criteria for receiving that award is based upon getting the proof that your vaccine injury occurred in a very narrow frame of time, and then you look at the epidemiological evidence, you talk with immunologists, you talk with people, and every specialty of medicine, they will tell you many people will have a delayed reaction to a vaccine. It might be a month, 6 months, a year, even 2 years. For 18 years, sir, I have been trying to help the Gulf War veterans in the United States do something that I'm appalled to say that our own federal agencies has failed to do, including Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr. administrations. Acknowledge that 400,000 GIs who are sick with Gulf War syndrome actually have something other than post-traumatic stress disorder. I've done 3 award-winning documentaries on their plight. I have interviewed over 1,000 of them.
I've interviewed people who have massive body lesions, who have rare and exotic diseases, who have brain and neurological disorders, having nothing to do with post-traumatic, didn't even go to the Gulf Theater. They got the vaccines, the experimental anthrax vaccine, the experimental botulism vaccine, that the FDA, similar to what it's doing with swine flu, gave a pass, an exemption on long-term studies. Those Americans, those brave, courageous Americans, over 33,000 are reported dead. Their statistics appear nowhere, only by those who are Gulf War veterans putting together their own figures. They have gone to Washington. I've gone to Washington to interview Chris Dodd. I've gone to Washington to interview the people in the presence of the Gulf War vet, a man who got out of bed in the morning, had to crawl to get to his daughter because his legs were swollen the size of a football. A woman who had no illnesses, 22 years old, was in the Gulf, that got the vaccines, and now couldn't walk, in bed 16, 18 hours a day. The government has refused to acknowledge that Gulf War syndrome is legitimate. To this day. Now, I've read the hearings, and I saw all of those white coat phenomena, the scientists and physicians that we bow down to, marching in and giving testimony. I have every word they said at every committee hearing. Rockefeller Committee, all of them, and they all were in gross denial. Whose interests were they serving? Certainly not the sick Gulf vets. And you would see the Gulf West determined to get their story out. No one listening. No one has looked at the facts. There are 44 separate studies, 44 today, that showed the Gulf War syndrome is real and that it was due to what they were exposed to. These are real diseases. For a decade and more, they said there's no diseases. Now, I'm wanting to ask, you're willing to inject pregnant women in this state or fire them if they don't take the vaccine. Are you or any member here, anyone, is the governor, is anyone in the state going to be held personally and legally responsible if that developing fetus gets that mercury into their brain and ends up with a learning disability, with autism, with any one of the autism spectrum disorders, or ends up with some form of intellectual deficit? We have an epidemic. I did another award-winning documentary called The Drugging of Our Children. Appalling to know that when you were going to school, when I was going to school, no kid got drugged. Today, 10 million American children don't go to school before they get a class 2 drug, the same class as cocaine. Do we actually have a new epidemic that didn't happen to any generation in American history, anywhere else in the world, but suddenly happened in the last 25 years to the newest generation? They have a brain chemical imbalance? No. And yet the so-called experts, the very experts that you would rely upon, are saying, well, must be something wrong, that's why we're giving them the drugs must work. And I say, no. The number one cause of death in the United States in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. How many kids committed suicide when you were going to school, sir? None when I went to school, and I went to the largest high school in my state, 5,500 students, Barkley Creek High School. So what do we have? A whole new generation of people where autism is suddenly showing its head that never before? If autism were historically there, then everyone in their 50s, 60s, and 70s would start representing at least percentage-wise population autism in adults. We don't see it. It doesn't exist. And yet we refuse to acknowledge that what they're getting early in life could be contributing to it. So I'm saying I'm not willing to sit by quietly and allow women who've been used and abused by the medical authorities, the very same medical doctors who have sit here with great certainty and enormous hubris and contempt for women, say, your body is our concern, your developing fetus is in our best interest to make sure it's born healthy, and yet give them mercury. You ask that same doctor, would you give that woman lead? Would you give anyone in this room lead? If you did, you would go to jail. So you're going to give something more toxic than lead to every one of these pregnant women? Sir, I'm appalled and I'm offended in the extreme, and I will not contain my concern, because these same women that we're so-called interested in, for the last 35 years, I've been one of the leading people advocating against synthetic hormone replacement therapy. We know now it causes breast cancer, ovarian cancer, heart attacks, dementia, and stroke. 10% minimum, 13% more likely. You're talking about 10 million women. That's 1.3 million women we're allowing to be sacrificed on the altar of ignorance or greed or hubris. My mother died of a heart attack in the middle of the night, and she was taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Now, another part of this scenario is the number one cause of death in the United States is American medicine. I did a report that has not been refuted with five other MD board certified and PhDs called Death by Medicine. I was intrigued when the American Medical Association said that the number 3 or 4 causes of death in the United States was...
I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break and come back. Let's now go over and say hello. Before we go to our guests, let's say hello to one of our scholars in residence, Richard Gale, and he's here also to get pushback on the stupidity, the vileness, the insensitivity to, in effect, giving the finger to 7 million parents whose children have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and say they're all wrong. It was never vaccines. To controlling the CDC, to controlling the FDA, corrupt organizations, controlling the media by saying no vaccine causes autism. So they brought out a new article. We will deconstruct it as we do all the time. Richard, deconstruct the argument that they're giving, please.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, you know, right now they've pulled out all stops. All weapons have been drawn. It's a nationwide effort that we're seeing in Congress being spearheaded by a Democrat California representative, Adam Schiff, who's now reached out to Google, Amazon, Facebook to have them start censoring all information concerning vaccine, anything that's going to question the official word about vaccines, that they're safe and effective. And basically, I think one of the, at the heart of this is also the fact that Congress is now becoming the entity that determines what users can use on social media or what they have access to. And, of course, you know, the Constitution strictly kind of limits congressional powers and has delegates, you know, the safeguards. So there is an abuse here under the First Amendment. Now, Schiff is stating that, and there is a subcommittee in Congress convening right now. I know many of the medical doctors and scientists, mothers from all kinds of, from different autism groups that are all traveling across the country and from the Midwest to be present to protest at this meeting. But what Schiff is basically saying is that there's overwhelming consensus in the scientific and medical communities that vaccines are both effective and safe. And so if we could just begin there, this is the classic argument we're always going after, is that there is no overwhelming consensus. That's just a hard truth that they're going to reject and they're refusing to agree with. And the evidence is that the vaccines are neither all effective or safe. And there's John Ioannidis. He's a professor of medicine at Stanford University, who the Atlantic once even called him as one of the most influential scientists alive. And He's become a scourge of all the sloppy science in the medical literature, in peer-reviewed literature. He wrote an article that's now almost, it's reached legendary status. It was back in 2005, where he said that the vast majority of all the published findings that you find in medical literature today are probably false, and the majority of what we call expert opinion of what Adam Schiff is referring to, or overwhelming consensus, is often nothing other than a prevailing bias that persists throughout the medical community. And then you even have that Dave Sackett, you know, the father of evidence-based medicine, who said that, you know, half of what you learn in medical school will be shown to be either dead wrong or out of date within 5 years of your graduation. So what there is no medical consensus concerning the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Second, I think that's important is that people have to realize that vaccines are drugs, and nobody you find, even congressional leaders and doctors will criticize the adverse effects of drugs. But your vaccines are categorized in the same way as every drug is categorized, as A, being it is safe and effective, and then B, and C, and D, and on down the line. No, all vaccines are B or C drug, meaning that there's no studies that have ever been performed on the safety of a fetus, you know, when a mother is vaccinated. And two, that there's no credible studies or no studies performed at all whether any of these vaccines could contribute to cancer. So that's right there. Nobody can argue this. So to say that vaccines are 100% safe is ludicrous, because the vaccines themselves are not even categorized as being perfectly safe. I think that's one of the clearest arguments that one can have. And we can go to the criticism. If Facebook is going to censure information opposing vaccines, what else will they censor? Are they going to be willing to censor the publications coming out of the CDC, on vaccine schedules? Is Google going to censor?
Thank you. We have to take a break and come back with our guest. We'll be back. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world and all of our syndicated stations for carrying this program. And our sister station in WBAI in New York, where I've been on the air every day for 43 years. How often during those 43 years have we paid attention to the rent? People don't talk about rent much unless they can't afford it. And today it's being talked about, but not by the mainstream media. The question is why. My guest from San Francisco, Alana Simuels, is on to talk about this. She is a San Francisco-based staff writer for The Atlantic, where she writes about economics and housing and technology. She's been a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and other publications. She holds a master's degree in global politics from London School of Economics and received a degree in American history from Harvard. And you can read her investigative stories at the Atlantic Monthly's website, atlanticmonthly.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
During the past couple of years, there's been articles and even books that the U.S. has entered into a rental era. It used to be that as the older generation passed, the younger generation enters the workforce, marries, and then looks, or doesn't marry, and looks to getting a home. All that's changed. That's no longer this issue. Younger adults frequently, A, don't want to have a home, don't want to get married, don't want to have kids. Some do, some don't. But almost all of them are strapped for cash. They're heavy in debt. The latest figures I just saw this morning was student debt is now $2 trillion. Last time it was $1.5 trillion. And they have other debt as well. They don't even have good credit. They have bad credit, many of them. And their work barely provides, for a lot of them, a standard of living that could allow them to purchase a home. Also, home prices are, again, higher than average wage earning, and so being a renter is the new norm. But since 2008, burst of the mortgage bubble, Wall Street banks and hedge funds and corporate investors and equity firms have taken over the lucrative land owner business in many urban parts of the country. You focused a lot on Atlanta and its suburbs, and they have bought these homes and properties through the federal agency Fannie Mae. You give the figure of about $36 billion spent on buying 200,000 homes. And in Atlanta alone, these private firms own upwards of 90% of all foreclosed homes. Now, in retrospective, I think it was realistic for the government to want to stabilize the real estate market after the recession. But now what might have been good intentions at first is becoming a nightmare for tens of thousands or more of families or individuals. They simply cannot afford the rent. So I'd like you to go in detail on how we got to where we're at and look at Vancouver. I just saw the average rent there, San Francisco, that whole area, Los Angeles, New York, even Brooklyn. So a lot of people are finding they have to move far away, sometimes an hour and a half to 2 hour commute, just to be able to work in an environment that they can't afford to rent. The forum is yours.
Right. So there is a lot of foreclosures during the recession, obviously, and there are a lot of empty homes, you know, in areas like the suburbs of Georgia, like the suburbs or Inland Empire of Los Angeles. And there's no one really that had the money to buy them because of the recession. You know, a lot of people were foreclosed on during the recession or didn't get new jobs. Wages were pretty stagnant. So there are all these empty homes. So the government was kind of looking around and saying, these homes are bringing down the value of other homes. If we don't stabilize this market, we're going to be in trouble, which was probably, you know, the right instinct. But what they did was they made it easier for institutional investors to buy large numbers of homes at once. You know, before they'd have to go to different auctions and it was just kind of a pain. The government made it easier to buy pools of homes. So an investor could buy 1,000 homes at once. And so with that, a lot of investors started coming into the market and started buying large pools of homes. The idea was that they would buy these homes and they'd rent them out to tenants who had perhaps lost their homes in the recession. And, you know, they would be good landlords. The tenants would have someplace to live. You know, everything would work out. But unfortunately, as a lot of these companies have gone public and have, you know, started to have these shareholders, there's been a lot of pressure to cut costs. And that's often meant passing a lot of responsibilities on to tenants, adding a lot of fees, raising rents pretty quickly, making tenants responsible for more and more things. So these companies are doing pretty well financially, but there are lots of tenants who are just having kind of nightmare after nightmare living in these homes.
When you think of what it used to be around, well, it depends upon which decade. From the 50s to the 70s, it was around 15% to 20%. Then it went up to around 30, 35%. Now it's over 50% in many cities for rent. If you're paying 50% of what you're earning on rent, you're not going to have enough money for all the other necessities of life.
Right. You see a lot of people who either were foreclosed during the recession or, as you mentioned, you know, millennials perhaps are delaying getting married and buying homes. People who started their jobs during the recession are going to have lower wages for life. So that makes it harder to save up. And then you have extremely high rents in a lot of urban areas like San Francisco, like Atlanta, like New York. And so people just can't afford to buy. But increasingly, they also can't afford to rent because these companies just keep raising the rents. And there are so many renters out there that they're able to do that. You know, one of the things that these companies do is they, you know, really use kind of automated services to raise to determine the rent. So they'll look at an algorithm. They'll say, this is what the rent should be in this market. And then the tenant will get a letter, you know, your rent is being raised $500. With individual landlords, you have more of a relationship. And so you might be able to negotiate more. You know, if you're late on rent, if you're a couple days late, you can say, you know, the check hasn't come yet, but I promise I'll get it to you on Monday. With these corporate landlords, if you're 2 days late, you automatically get an eviction notice. So, you know, at a time when it's harder to rent and rent is getting more expensive, you have these corporate landlords that are not budging at all on rent or payments.
Would you please name some of the worst home rental corporations and who are their parent banks and companies? And since the recession, how profitable has it been for these companies? You just mentioned it's profitable, but how profitable is it for them to be in the landlord business? And also, now that they're landlords, are they really taking care of the properties? Are they maintaining the plumbing and windows, or the roofing? Do they have that capability? And what's happening to the renter if they're living in a place that is no longer in good repair, don't have the money to repair it themselves, and the landlord doesn't care?
Sure. So there were a lot of these companies started in, you know, 2011, 2012. Blackstone created Invitation Homes. Cerberus created First Key Homes. Colony Capital created Colony American. There's another one called American Homes for Rent. Right now, a lot of these companies have merged. So the two biggest ones are Invitation Homes and American Homes for Rent, and they control nearly 60% of the market. There are also specific companies in different markets. So Sylvan is the one I ran into a lot in Atlanta, for instance. So these companies are doing pretty well. If you look at the analysts who cover them, Invitation Homes especially has buy ratings, which means investors think that the stock price is going to go up. And then, you know, one of the ironies is you have these companies that could be argued contributed to the foreclosure crisis in the first place, like Morgan Stanley or BlackRock, who have a lot of shares of these companies, who are really making a lot of money when Invitation Homes does well. As to the question of can they afford to repair these homes, I mean, it depends on who you ask. I think they would say that they address complaints in a timely manner. But, you know, I talked to a lot of tenants who said they filed a complaint on the portal, because a lot of this is centralized. So you have to go through a portal. You can't really talk to a person. You file a request for something to be repaired, and the company may get to it. It may not get to it. The company usually tries to find the cheapest contractor. One family I talked to had floods over 3 years in their house. No one ever fixed it. No one ever pulled up the carpet, even though the carpets were soggy. Finally, I had this giant flood that sent 6 inches of water through their house. This contractor came and said, oh, there's a problem with the hot water heater, and also your pipes have been recalled. You know, we have to take out all the pipes. And they gave the company a quote, and the company said, no, thanks. And they called some guy, you know, who came in his Honda Civic and just cleaned up the house. So, you know, they may be addressing it, but they're kind of putting Band-Aids on a lot of the problems.
And sounds like slumlords to me.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things is I think this problem is going to get worse as they don't repair houses, because, you know, houses take a lot of work, they take a lot of money, and the more you put on a Band-Aid and don't fix a problem, the worse it's going to get. So I think down the road, we're just going to see more problems with these landlords.
That's unfortunate, because think how helpless the tenant feels. They've got a double negative. They don't have money for a regular house. They're probably renting something that's the maximum they can afford, and then it's no longer providing a quality of living space. Corporations, to me at least, this is my personal opinion, are motivated solely by profit, not ethics, not morals. That doesn't mean that some of the people in those corporations don't hold ethics and morals. It's just that that's not the bottom line. And that means a downsizing whenever it will increase venue. And what is happening is that maintenance responsibilities that are normally assumed by a landlord, as you mentioned, are dumped on the tenants or to a guy in a small car. And it's getting worse. That's the feedback I've gotten. It seems to me that as the corporate landlord business becomes more lucrative, maybe you could give us an idea of the range of profit or percentage of profit, more homes will be purchased by these mega investor firms and banks, and we're likely to see a major economic collapse ahead given the enormous national debt, and if it time comes, which some of us believe it will, where the dollar is no longer the exclusive reserve currency and is having to compete with other currencies, that would mean more home foreclosures and more corporate home buying. So as a trained economist, where do you foresee home ownership and the rental market heading in the future?
Well, I actually would push back that companies are going to buy a lot more homes, because right now prices are still pretty high. And so it doesn't really make sense for them economically to buy these homes and rent them out, just because they're not going to make a lot of money. When they bought these homes during the recession, they were at bottom basement prices. They were, $100,000. Now they're $400,000. So it made a lot of sense to buy these homes and rent them out, because, they made a lot of money from the rent. What they are doing is they're building homes to rent. So they're partnering with construction companies and building new homes for people to rent. And, in one way that's good, because it creates more of a rental market. But because these companies, have a lot of inventory in certain metro areas, they really can control what rents are charged. The companies are doing pretty well. Interestingly, they're REITs, or real estate investment trusts. So they have to pay out a large amount of their money to shareholders every year. That's just one of the rules of REITs. But share prices have gone up significantly since these companies went public.
I appreciate the quality of your scholarship and your writing. I read your articles in The Atlantic and online. And thank you for the good work in looking after the average person's interest. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
From San Francisco, talking about how Wall Street and its investors, with Washington's help, have entered the home and apartment rental market business, is Alana Semuels. That's spelt S-E-M-U-E-L-S. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. I want to thank you for listening. And remember that very important webinar on Sunday at 1 o'clock. Go to GaryNull.com to get more on that and join us. And it'll be an enlightening and eye-opening webinar. Have a nice day, everyone.